Sean Carroll is a theoretical physicist at Caltech, and he's the kind of guy who likes to speculate about the meaning of it all. He's just come out with a book with a suitably sweeping title, The Big Picture, on the origins of life, meaning, and the universe itself. That's intellectual catnip for Steve Paulson, so of course he sat down to talk with Sean.
Sean, you've coined a phrase that describes your philosophical outlook on the world, what you call poetic naturalism. What is that?
Well, naturalism is an old idea. It's just the idea that there's only one world, the natural world, the world that we perceive by doing science experiments and so forth, the world that obeys the laws of nature. Poetic is added on because there's different forms of naturalism. Naturalists disagree with each other, which is a good, healthy thing. There are very austere, bare-bones naturalists who really think that the only thing that truly exists is the fundamental description of reality, you know, the electrons and protons and neutrons, or the quantum wave function of the universe. That means you don't believe that chairs and tables are real. They're just illusions because they're made out of all these things. And I think that goes too far, personally. And then on the other hand, there's the naturalists that aren't quite willing to go all the way to the physical world. They want to say that there's only the natural world, but they want to add something to it, either mental properties that the physical world can have over and above its physical properties to help explain consciousness, or perhaps objective moral principles that tell us right from wrong in addition to what the universe actually does. So poetic naturalism is in between because I don't believe there's anything extra other than the physical world, but there are many ways of talking about the physical world. That's where the poetry of it all comes in.
Right. So there's kind of a religious framework for talking about some of these things as well. And I mean, that's atheism. And clearly you are in the atheist camp, but my sense is that you find that label somewhat limiting.
It's not that I find it limiting. You know, I'm very happy to accept it. It's just that it's less informative. There are naturalists who are not atheists. You could not believe in God, but you could believe in something spiritual over and above the natural world. Or you could believe in the existence of immaterial souls, right? Like René Descartes did. He was also religious, but there's room in between being a naturalist and being a conventional theist.
Mm-hmm. Now, I was surprised to read that you grew up in an Episcopal church, and you liked it. In fact, you say you loved the mysteries and the doctrine.
Yeah, it's fun. I mean, if that's what the universe had turned out to be like, I would have been fascinated to study those things. My favorite book of the Bible was the book of Revelation because it was just the most awesome and, you know, mind-blowing. It was like Game of Thrones 2,000 years ago, really. But I eventually decided that probably was not the most correct description of the world. And I don't think it's actually surprising. I think that many contemporary people who are not very religious grew up in religious households one way or the other.
Mm-hmm. What do you consider the most remarkable insights from the world of physics in recent decades?
Recent decades?
Yeah.
We're still kind of cleaning up the mess made by the early 20th century in physics with relativity and quantum mechanics and so forth.
I'm interested in how you describe that as the mess.
Oh, God, it's a terrible mess. It's embarrassment. It's terrible.
Because there are so many mysteries that still haven't been resolved?
Well, mysteries are good. Mysteries are fine. Mysteries are what drive science. But that's not the embarrassment. The embarrassment, the mess, to me, is the fact that quantum mechanics is our most successful theory of nature. It is clearly true in some way, in some version, in some sense. And yet we don't know what it is. We've been using it for, 90 years now. And if you said, okay, what does quantum mechanics say? 30 different physicists are going to give you 25 different answers.
What do you mean you don't know what it is?
We don't know what it is. Like if you have general relativity, Einstein's theory of gravity, okay? Everyone knows what that is. It says that there is something called space-time. Space-time is four-dimensional. It has a certain way of measuring distances in time and space. And there's an equation called Einstein's equation that tells you how space-time curves. Everything is perfectly well-defined, unambiguous. That's what you want in science. In quantum mechanics, you say, okay, well, there's stuff called wave functions. And when you observe a wave function, it collapses. But then instantly, people start disagreeing. Like, does it really collapse? What does it count as an observation? Does the collapse represent our knowledge, or is that a physical truth? Is there some extra variable that is making it collapse? Is it deterministic? We don't know any of these things. And that's an embarrassment and a mess to me.
But has progress been made on these fronts?
Yes, absolutely. You know, in the 20s and 30s, right after you invented quantum mechanics. People worried about this stuff a lot. Schrodinger and Heisenberg and Bohr and Einstein would argue back and forth in a, you know, this old school, heavily philosophical European way of thinking about things. And then the 40s and 50s came along, and we needed to make bombs, and we needed to like smash particles together and watch what was happening. And it became much more practical, and forget about the philosophy, let's just do the calculations. And it's only been, I think, in the last couple of decades, a little bit of attention has been refocused on these foundational issues.
And yet, I mean, going back to that philosophical orientation of those early 20th century physicists, it would seem that those big questions are still with us. I mean, you know, what is the fundamental, ultimate nature of reality? And what about questions about determinism, for instance? We never know if a particle, where it is at any particular moment. I mean, aren't those questions sort of still out there?
Well, some questions are still out there. I mean, the fact that we don't know the fundamental nature of reality yet should not be taken as a sign that physicists have somehow failed over the past few decades. We haven't known that for a very long time. When Democritus came up with the idea of atoms, it took over 2,000 years to get good evidence for it. The question of determinism, for example, we thought we had solved. If you were Isaac Newton, or even better, if you were Pierre-Simon Laplace, who came after Newton and really understood the implications of Newtonian mechanics for questions of determinism, you thought that the universe was clockwork. You thought that there absolutely was determinism. It's right there in the equations. Our confidence in that result was undermined by the appearance of quantum mechanics, because in quantum mechanics, all you can do when you have an experimental setup and you want to predict what will happen is predict the probability that you will see something rather than the certainty of it. So now we're back to not knowing whether the universe is fundamentally deterministic. There are deterministic versions of quantum mechanics, like the many worlds interpretation.
Which you subscribe to, right?
Yeah, that's right. So I think that the universe is most likely deterministic. But there are other models that are also on the table and plausible, which are fundamentally non-deterministic. So I think that that question has now again been reopened.
Let me just pursue this for a moment, this many worlds interpretation of the multiverse. I mean, this idea that, you know, it's not just this one universe in our observable universe. It's an infinite number, right?
Well, it's at least a very big number.
Yes. It would seem that there's no empirical evidence for this. I mean, yes, the mathematical models might suggest this. Are we sort of moving outside the realm of science to embrace a model like that?
No, there's lots of empirical evidence for it. All the evidence for quantum mechanics is empirical evidence for it. It's really more a matter of courage than anything else. If you believe in quantum mechanics at all, for example, you believe that an individual particle like an electron can be in a superposition of two possible states. Let's say it's a rotating, spinning clockwise or counterclockwise. The question is, do you think a person can be in a superposition of having seen an electron spin clockwise or having seen an electron spin counterclockwise? And now if you just take at face value the equations of quantum mechanics as written down by Heisenberg and Schrodinger, etc., the answer should obviously be yes. I mean, there's no difference between an electron and a person, except a person is bigger. So if you don't undergo some failure of nerve, you would say, sure, these people can be in superpositions also. And for that matter, the whole universe can be in a superposition.
But in this version, there are many, many versions of you, Sean Carroll, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, you really think that. I mean, you think some decisions you made some years ago, that created a whole different Sean Carroll, and there are thousands, millions of Sean Carrolls out there.
Do I detect that you have lacked the courage to believe in the many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics? Is that you've lost your nerve?
I think I have lost my nerve, yeah.
I mean, nothing that you're saying now is a science argument, right?
No,
it's just
right.
Like
you're right.
Vaguely uncomfortable.
Yes. Okay. So this is not good.
That's not really enough. I have a theory that fits the data and is well defined and is beautifully simple and can be applied to any kind of physical system. And you say, yeah, but there's a lot of me's out there. It kind of is creepy.
But isn't this a theory that you will never be able to prove?
Well, you never prove any theory in science. That's not what science does.
Okay. It seems that science still really does not have an explanation for two fundamental questions about reality. One is how the universe got started. In other words, you know, was there anything before the Big Bang? I mean, sort of what we've just been talking about. And the other is the relationship between mind and brain. I mean, how the immaterial stuff of our minds, our thoughts and our feelings somehow emerges from our brains. It's still a huge mystery. Would you say those are two basically unanswered questions still?
Yeah, I think that of all the unanswered questions we have, those are the two that are the least surprising that they're unanswered. I mean, you've literally picked the thing that is as far away as it is possible to get from us now, the beginning of the universe, and the single most complicated thing that we know about in the universe, human consciousness. So the fact that we don't understand them, again, the least surprising thing in the world.
Do you think we'll ever understand those questions?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Consciousness. No problem. Wait, no problem for consciousness.
Yeah. No problem for the universe, for consciousness, for the origin of life. I mean, that's, you know, look, it's easy to forget how far we've come. Think about what we knew about the universe 100 years ago. We didn't know it was expanding. We didn't know there were other galaxies. We knew essentially nothing accurate about the universe on large scales. And within the course of 100 years, we put together this beautifully accurate picture that takes us from 1 second after the Big Bang to 13.8 billion years after the Big Bang that fits the data all along the way. To think that 100 years from now, we will not make similarly mind-blowing amounts of progress seems to be ahistorical to me.
Hmm. Now, you said that your book is essentially an exploration of ontology, of, you know, of what this is all about, in a sense. What is it that we still need to understand? If there was sort of some fundamental message, if that's the right word, that you wanted to get across with your book, what would it be?
Maybe those are two separate questions. I think there's so many things that we still need to understand. We don't understand, as you've already said, the origin of the universe. We don't understand the origin of life. We don't understand the nature of consciousness. We don't have a consensus among each other on how to be nice to each other or how to live meaningful lives. The messages of my book are, number one, that there is one universe, the natural world, that obeys the laws of nature. And number two, that's okay. That it is not any cause for Nietzschean, Kierkegaardian deep anxiety about the nature of reality. It is a challenging view of the world because it sort of removes some of the crutches that we could lean on to give our lives meaning and purpose if we thought there was extra stuff out there. But it's also liberating in the sense that what the world is, what our lives are up to us to make something of. They're not given instructions. It's truly a creative, a universe full of opportunity. So I think it's actually kind of a happy message at the end of the day.
Hmm. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Steve.
Caltech physicist Sean Carroll talking with Steve Paulson. Sean's new book is called The Big Picture.